You're listening to Maximum Medicine Radio with host Doc Martin. Stay tuned in or call in. You won't want to miss what's happening next. How do you step into your maximum potential? How do you connect your spiritual drive with your physical path? Stick around as Doc Martin takes listeners on a journey through the seen and unseen, the accepted and the unbelievable. Get ready to meet the maximum you the world needs on Maximum Medicine Radio with Doc Martin now. Hi, everybody. This is Maximum Medicine. I'm Doc Martin. We're back. And my guest tonight is Stefan Schwartz, and you'll hear a lot about him. I'm going to introduce him to you in a minute. But what I wanted him here for is he is an expert on remote viewing, which he'll explain, and consciousness, at least what's known out there. So I have some questions because we all have questions about all of this. Stefan, thank you so much for being here tonight.
My pleasure, Sharon.
So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Stefan's bio and tell you about the parts that intrigued me, and there's a whole lot more. He is a researcher, a scholar. He has worked with the Institute of Human Science, Saybrook University. He is an author on the journal Explore. He is a senior, is it pronounced Samueli?
Samueli, yes.
Samueli Fellow for Brain, Mind, and Healing, a research director at the Rhine Research Center, which I looked up a little. It's about paranormal and consciousness in Durham, North Carolina. And you guys might have heard when he was doing remote viewing with at least two renowned, we call them psychics, but maybe we're being a little too general, for remote viewing for archaeology, specifically buildings in Egypt, remote viewing for sunken ships. He worked in the Navy when he was younger at the Naval Institute or Department of Navy.
No, I was the special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations for research and analysis.
Okay, more research. Good for you. He has studied parapsychology. And I want to tell you about the thing that intrigued me the most. If that wasn't enough to blow your mind, this to me was amazing. So, Stefan, I remember the story when I was looking at many of your videos that somehow a couple arrives in your remote farm in Tidewater, Virginia, and something occurs. We can probably debate that all night, what really happened. And you end up in Virginia Beach as a young man, at which time you spend 5 years working at the Casey Foundation, reading everything in the Casey Library. Do I have that story right?
I read all of the Edgar Casey readings. There are about 15,000 of them.
And in that time, you obviously got intrigued by how does this minimally educated Kentucky farm boy find answers and predict the future. That must have captivated you.
Well, the Casey material, I didn't know anything about consciousness research when I got interested in this. I had this unusual experience that got me down to Virginia Beach. And I began to read this stuff, and I wanted to know how the first reading I ever read when I was taken to the ARE for the first time, I walked into the library, and along one of the walls was a whole wall from floor to ceiling of these green loose leaf notebooks. And the woman who had brought me there said, well, those are the readings. I didn't know what a reading was, and she explained to me as what she understood. And I, at random, just pulled one of these green notebooks off the shelf and opened it up, and it was a reading given in 1936. That's important. for a woman. And he said in the reading, Casey said, she had been a member of the Essene community at Kirbet Qumran, not the name, but he described where it was, and I recognized it as Kirbet Qumran, and that she had been a member of the Essene community and a teacher of astrology. And I can tell you, Sharon, it is possible for your hair to stand on end. Because before I was drafted into the Army, I worked for National Geographic. And one of the last things I did before I left to go into the service was research on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I knew, for an article I was doing, and I knew that in 1936, there was not a person alive on Earth who knew that the Dead Sea Scrolls existed. They had no idea where they were, even if they did exist. They were discovered by a young Bedouin tribes boy who was a shepherd, who would chucked a rock into a cave opening and heard a clunk and went down to see what the clunk was about and found these urns, which contained what we now call the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that was in 1947, 11 years after this reading was given. At the time the reading was given, 1936, first of all, the general belief was that the Essene community was a schismatic order of Jewish monks. That was from Josephus, who was the authority, considered the authority on this. No one knew that women were involved at all. And certainly nobody knew that they had any interest in astrology. But in 47, 11 years later, when this young boy found these things, and they were then taken out and examined by scholars, they discovered also, they began an archaeological dig in what was thought at the time to be a minor outpost of the Emperor Vespasian. And it turned out this was the Essene community that everybody had been talking about. They didn't know where it was. And when they did excavation, they discovered that there were female skeletons. So women had clearly been involved. And when they translated the Dead Sea Scrolls, they are obsessed with astrology. Mm-hmm. So the question that I had, and I asked this woman that had brought me to the ARE, how could this guy possibly know this information 11 years before it was discovered? And that's what started the whole thing, because I wanted to know how it was possible you could know something that nobody else in the world knew, and you could know it years before it was discovered.
That does make my hair stand on end. But the other part of this story that makes my hair stand on end is, have you reflected back? I'm sure you have. What have you made of this couple that arrives, having never known you before, and are instrumental in you leaving your rural family farm and landing at ARE, which begins your entire MO of experience and exposure? What do you have thoughts about that?
I mean, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I've done a great deal of research on this. Yes, just to explain to people what happened. I had been in New York. I came out of the service, and I went to work for a newspaper, and I wrote a script for Colonial Williamsburg. They made a movie out of it. They used to show it at the Information Center. I don't know if they still do. But in any case, I wrote this movie, and I sent it up to a guy I had met in the Army, and he invited me to come up, and I was offered a job with a company called Screen Gems, which was then a big television production company. And I wrote a screen adaptation of a book by I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, Bud Schulberg. And I sent this script that I had written in Williamsburg, and they liked it, and so they got me to do this adaptation of this Bud Schulberg play. so many years ago. And I went to, you know, I was in New York. I was a young man, 22. I was working as a screenwriter. I was making what in those days was quite a lot of money. And I thought I was on a successful path and everything was right. And I went to a party that Truman Capote gave, a very famous writer. And I went down the hall to go to the bathroom. And as I came back, there was a antique Italian gilt mirror on the wall. And I looked in this mirror and said completely spontaneously, without any thought about what I was about to say or anything, no plan, I just looked at myself for a long time in the mirror and I said, you are becoming an unattractive person. Your values are all screwed up. You need to do something different. But I had no idea what to do. I looked down the hall and there were all these famous people at this party. And I walked out and said goodbye, good night to them, and left and slept on the sand in the beach. And this was on Fire Island. I went back to Manhattan, got in my car and drove down to Virginia. And it was the only time, it is the only time in my life I've ever been depressed, because I just did not know what I was saying, what I meant by what I had said. And I didn't know what to do about it. I just was at a place where I didn't know what to do. And I was sitting on the porch at my family's farm in Tidewater, down in Gloucester County. And I looked up one day as I was sitting there in this depression. I just didn't know what to do. And there was this couple walking in the gardens. And this was a house that was built in 1653. And everyone who had ever owned it had been in my family. It had been a land grant to my mother's family. Had loved it, and it had very extensive gardens. And I looked up, and here is this couple walking in the garden, and they're dressed like people in New York. He's wearing a gray double-breasted suit, and she's got this quite smart linen dress on. And I look over where the cars would park, and no car. So I thought, how in the world? I looked down at the dock, no boat. I thought, who are these people, and where in the world did they come from, and why are they here? And they saw me looking at them, and they came over and opened the door, and they came into the screen porch, and this woman looked at me for a moment, and instead of introducing herself, she said to me, do you believe in reincarnation? And I had never thought about it. I'd never given it any thought, and I thought about it for a minute there, and I said to her, well, you know, I don't know anything about it, but yes, I think I probably do. It's very symmetrical. And then I said to her, but, you know, wait a minute. You know, who are you and why are you here? And they introduced themselves as Ed and Paula Fitzgerald. And she said, well, we're here because I had a dream about you. And I wrote down how we should drive to get to you, because I said, how could you possibly get here? We're at the end of a 10-mile school bus road, and our lane was a mile long. So I said, how did you get here? And she said, well, I had this dream, and I'm supposed to introduce you to Edgar Casey. Do you know who Edgar Casey is? I said, no, I have no idea who Edgar Casey is, and I cannot understand how you could possibly have found this place and why you would do this. None of this makes any sense to me at all. And she explained that this dream, and that they were students of Edgar Casey's readings. And I looked at this guy, and he looked vaguely familiar. And I realized that I had met him once at a film conference. And I said to him, are you the Ed Fitzgerald who was the production designer on Magnificent Seven? It was then a very popular movie. And he said, yes. So that gave them a kind of gravitas. They didn't seem quite as weird as I had originally thought. And just then a car came down the lane and with a young couple. And she said, give me your telephone number. I gave her my card and they got in the car and drove away. And I was watching the car go down the lane and I thought, what the hell just happened? I mean, what? None of it made any sense. And about a week or so later, I got this call inviting me down to the ARE, and I got in my car because, as I said, I didn't know what to do. I was very depressed, and I drove down to Virginia Beach, and I got to the address I had been given, and there was a guy up on a ladder putting up a sign for what turned out to be a leather shop, a sandal shop. This is about 1964. And I said, I'm here to meet T.J. Davis. And he said, well, he's not here, but Joan is. And around the corner came this very attractive young woman about my age, had beautiful lavender eyes. And she said, I'm supposed to take you up to the ARE. And I said, what's the ARE? And she explained to me that it was the organization that had been created to hold the Casey material. And so we got in my car and I drove up. And then, as I said, she took me into the library, and I just pulled this green loose leaf notebook off and had this experience of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I thought, well, I've got to understand this stuff. So I called back and said, well, this is going to take a little longer than a weekend. It took 5 years. And I decided that I had enough money saved up from when I'd been in New York that I didn't need to get a job. I could do what I wanted to do at that point, and that was read all these readings. So I went to Gladys, who was Casey's archivist and lifelong secretary, and said, I want to read all the readings. She said, well, nobody's ever done that before. And I said, I know, but I want to read them in order because I want to see how they develop as it goes along. And she said, well, I'll help you. And she did. I met Hugh Lynn Casey, Edgar Casey's son, who was the director of the ARE, and I started this reading program, and I did it for about 2 years, 2.5 years. And then I thought, I need to compare this with what science knows about this, because this stuff was so bizarre. He spoke languages he didn't speak. He could describe what people were wearing who were thousands of miles away. I mean, I just didn't know what to do with any of it. And so I started reading the parapsychological literature, and I started with the same thing I always do. I started with the very first journal ever published, and I read them all. And what I could see was most of it was about proving that it existed. And I, by that time, I didn't have any doubt that it was real, because the Gladys Davis, his secretary and archivist, was a meticulous archivist, and she had all this paperwork which supported the accuracy of you know, Casey would give a reading, for instance, and he would say, we have the body, and oh, it's quite a large body in a striped pajamas, you know, weird things like that. And
that he shouldn't have known.
Yeah, and then, how could he possibly know that? The person was 1,000 miles away or whatever. And then there'd be a letter from the wife or the husband of the person saying, oh, yes, she was not feeling well, and she was in her striped pajamas, and I'm sorry to say she's quite overweight. So how could that possibly, you know, how could he possibly know that? Anyway, in 1968, I began, because Casey said other people could do this. I've never met anybody that could do it quite as the way he did, but in any case, I began to do experiments, and so I became an experimentalist, and I am an experimentalist, and so everything I know about consciousness, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a theoretician, I'm an experimentalist, and everything that I know about this subject is based on objectively verifiable data. So there's nothing speculative about it. And I've been doing that ever since. And I originally called it distant viewing. And then later, in 74, I think, 75, somewhere in there, Ingo Swann called it, who was one of the viewers, called it remote viewing. That's the term that is stuck. It's a terrible term, by the way, both of them, because it has nothing to do with distance and it has nothing to do with viewing. And it's nothing to do with remoteness. but that's the term. And so I, my original experiment, I created a grid in my back garden of this house I was living in, and originally had 12 squares in the grid, and then it eventually had 144 because it made for stronger statistical outcomes. And I would bury mason jars with things in them, or little 35 millimeter film canisters, for people who remember that. And I would put things in them, and I would send a mimeograph, that's how old this is, a mimeograph of the grid out to people all over the world that I knew. And I would say to them, I have buried something in the grid. Would you pick the grid, within the grid, which square I have selected? And if you can do that, would you then describe for me what I have buried in the grid? And they could do it exactly as Casey had said. And so that's what really began the whole thing. I found that not everybody could do it all the time, but some people were quite good at doing that. And they could not only do the location, but they could describe. For instance, I was married at that point, and I took my one of my wife's perfume bottles. You know, those, you used to have these little things that had squeezy knobs on a little bulb at the end, and it was a vaporizer for perfume. And she had this thing, and I put it in a mason jar and buried it. And the person said, well, it's a bottle, and it's got this little squeezy thing at one end, and there's a very strong smell of flowers. And in fact, it was Madame Rocha's perfume with a flower smell. So how could they possibly know that? And that's what got me started and what I've been doing ever since. Looking at what I have come to think of as non-local consciousness, an aspect of consciousness which is not physiologically based. And I became convinced, I met Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia. That's where I had gone to university. And he was doing this reincarnation research and getting this extraordinary information. And I met a man named George Richer, who wrote a book about what today we would call a near-death experience. And it was clear to me that there was what today we would call continuity of consciousness. That is, the consciousness existed prior to your incarnation, and it exists after your physical death. That there is an eternal self, that's what I call it. The religion calls it the soul. There is this aspect of you that existed before you were born, and it will exist after you're physically dead. And that what comes across from one life to another is information. And so I've been now doing this for 60 some years. What I now see is that this is an information phenomenon. It's not an energy phenomenon, which is the way most people talk about it. It's not about energy, it's about information. And the key to it is that what we call reality is a creation of intentioned consciousness, not only of humans, but of others. Max Planck, father of quantum mechanics, was interviewed by The Observer in 1931, and he didn't give very many interviews. And the reporter who interviewed him from The Observer newspaper in England said, my editor sent me up here to ask you one question. And he said, what's the question? And the journalist said, what have you learned? You and Einstein are the two most famous scientists in the world. What have you learned? And I don't know what they thought he was going to say, but what he said was, what I have learned is that consciousness is causal and fundamental. Space-time, what we call reality, arises from consciousness, not consciousness from space-time, which is the materialist view. You cannot get behind consciousness. It is the fundamental. And I believe that is correct, and it is confirmed by all of the consciousness research. One of the questions that I was interested in at the time, there was a huge debate going on, and the general idea was that what was then called telepathy, an old-fashioned word, I don't use it anymore, that it was like a walkie-talkie phenomena. There was a sender and a receiver and a signal, and that it was some kind of electromagnetic transmission. And so I carried out an experiment called the Deep Quest experiment. You can see I actually filmed it. I got Leonard Nimoy, Dr. Spock, to do be the narrator, the voiceover. And I demonstrated that using a submarine, putting people in a submarine and asking them to describe where other people were hiding, or before I did the submarine part, I sent out a chart and I asked people to locate a previously unknown wreck on the sea floor. And I was able to establish that it is not an electromagnetic phenomena. There's no signal, there's no sender, receiver. That whole model, which you hear people talk about, just isn't correct. What happens is you open to the non-local aspect of your consciousness, and you can, from that non-local domain, because it's an informational construct, you can get anything. And that's what remote viewing has showed, which was part of what freaks people out, particularly wealthy or famous or political leaders, is they realize there are no secrets. And it makes them very uncomfortable. But nonetheless, that's the truth of it. You can get information on anything.
And does consciousness have a form that we can talk about, a physical or in physics or quantum mechanics form?
No.
That's hard.
Quantum mechanics may be involved. Quantum entanglement may be part of how the non-local becomes local. We don't know that for sure, but a number of people are trying to explore that, and we'll find out. But that is just a transition process. The thing that you have to get clear about, and it changes your whole view of the world, mm-hmm. is that all consciousness is interconnected and interdependent. We live in a matrix of consciousness, for starters. We don't have dominion over the earth, as the Abrahamic thinking was. We live in this matrix of consciousness in which all consciousness is interconnected and interdependent. And the linkage is not at the physical level. It's at this non-local domain level. And again, I don't know what consciousness is, nor does anybody else. But what we do...
It is hard to wrap your brain around it.
Yes. Yes, it is. Because it requires rethinking everything you think you know about reality when you understand that people can hold conscious intention, for instance, and affect your well-being from a distance, or that they can go back from the future into the past and affect your well-being, as an example, or that you can... All of my research is what's called triple blind. That is, at the time that we do the research, no one knows the answer to the question. It only, if it's the archaeological excavation, reveals it, or if it's a predictive, precognitive, it only the future will reveal whether that it's correct. But what we find out is that, it is possible when you open to non-local consciousness that you have access to essentially anything. If you look at religion, all religions across the whole of history, geography, and culture, they all begin because one person has a non-local consciousness experience. Jesus gets baptized by John. He goes into the desert to meditate. The Buddha goes up to an ashram and he's taught to meditate and he awakens. Muhammad goes to the sacred cave of Hira. He has a non-local consciousness experience and begins to meditate and awakens. So that you'll notice that the key part of that whole business is that they meditate. And so if your viewers don't take anything else away from this interview, I will tell you that the way to do this is to develop the daily practice of meditation. It will give you the best gift you will ever get in your life, because it will allow you to open to this non-local aspect of consciousness, and it will transform your life in good ways.
Mm-hmm. And the thing also that is hard when our entire, as you said, our reality is based on time, space. And now all of a sudden you have to flip out of that to recognize that this concept is not time or space bound.
That's correct.
And it kind of blows, if you're a scientist, and truthfully, I was a physiologist before I became a medical student. And truthfully, it feels so, what's the word? Stodgy. It feels like it's missing so much. And then you blow my mind and take me out of space-time, which kind of throws you out of the science and the way they describe, you know, Einstein and this and that, and this has to be this and reality has to be that. It kind of sends you on a little mental rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's true. Well, interesting thing is that Planck, Einstein, Pauli, Heisenberg, Schrodinger, all of these men that are the people that created modern physics, all of them began as materialists. And they all ended up recognizing that consciousness was causal and fundamental, just as Planck did. They didn't start out that way. Their research, their experimental work, got them to that. If you think about that, I mean, the reason that materialism has become the dominant view in Western culture, not in Eastern culture, but Western culture, is because of the Council of Trent. Between 1545 and 1563, the Roman Catholic Church held 25 meetings of the Curia, and because science was just beginning and they were feeling threatened by it, and they were also feeling threatened by the Reformation movements that were beginning. And so they, at the end of this, after these 25 meetings that took place in Trento and Bologna, they issued an edict, and they said, everything that's about the physical world, that's you guys in science. Everything that has to do with spirit, read consciousness, that's our world. We control it. We are in charge of what is we say about it. If you get involved in our world and we can get our hands on you, we'll kill you, torture you and kill you. And they did. And so from 1563 onward, although individuals cared about consciousness, people like Newton, but they...
It put a big schism.
It created an enormous schism until the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when psychology, psychiatry, parapsychology, anthropology, sociology, all began, and they all began recognizing that there was something going on with consciousness. And so that brings us up to today, where slowly, but nonetheless, it is happening. Consciousness is becoming a fundamental reality for science, because materialist science simply cannot address a number of the issues that the research is showing. I mean, the book to read, if anybody's interested in this, is called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's by a man named Thomas Kuhn. who was the leading scientific historian and philosopher of the 20th century. And he describes how paradigm, he coined the term paradigm, and he describes how paradigms change because they are inadequate. And that's where we are now. Consciousness is becoming a part of, a foundational part of science today. It's still not the dominant view, but that's what's happening, particularly as younger scientists come on, because they recognize that materialism as a model of science simply is not adequate.
Yeah, and that's that stodgy feeling I get. But I wanna shift over to talk about being agents of change and how in the literal world we use terms like dreaming our world into being. But I wanted to offer, do you need a break? No. You need a short break. Okay.
No, I'm fine.
All right, wonderful. So when we're, those of us are, who are trying to grapple with the information of the unseen world that we don't know how to explain, the spiritual and metaphysical phenomena that happen, and a lot of times we're taught that the things that, quote, shamans and the indigenous spiritual people used to do was to be able to, quote, dream the world into being. And now that we're talking consciousness, first I want to ask you, what, how can we explain that now with what you know? And then how can we, and I mentioned we as I'm in a meditation group, how can we be good agents of bringing in the future, of shifting things? And that I want to talk about your book, The Eight Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. So I wondered if you wanted to comment on that at all.
Yes, well, Sharon, four times in my life, I've been involved with changing history. And in the 50s and 60s, I was just a young man, started as a teenager, involved in the civil rights movement because it seemed very unfair to me to treat people differently because of the color of their skin. I was more interested in the quality of their character. And I also thought it was very odd that women were treated as second-class citizens. It just seemed very strange to me, because a number of the most interesting people I had known were women. So I got involved with the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. In the 70s, I became the special assistant to the chief of naval operations and was part of the small team that transformed the American military from the elitist conscription organization that I had been in as a part of the Army into an all-volunteer meritocracy that was gender neutral and racially neutral. And then in the 80s, I got interested, because I thought we were going to have a nuclear war, I got interested in trying to create a better level of interaction between the Soviet Union and the United States, what came to be called citizen diplomacy. And throughout all of this, the consciousness movement, which I've been involved with. So I, starting about 30 years ago, I began looking at how do people create social transformation that fosters well-being, because I got to a place, particularly when I was with the Navy, and was I was also part of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Secretary of Defense discussion group on innovation technology in the future. I came to believe that, again, based on data, not on politics or partisanship or any of that, based on the data, it was very clear, is very clear, that when you pick the option that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being, that that's always, I can't find a contradictory example, That is always the optimal, best choice. It's the most efficient, the most effective, the easiest implemented, the most productive, the nicest to live under, and the much, much, much cheaper than any other option. So I got interested in how do you create social change that fosters well-being, because that's the thing that I am interested in. How do you foster well-being? Because that is always the best choice. And I could give you thousands of examples. But in any case, so I started studying the biographies, the diaries, the notebooks, accounts of major social changes. And what I discovered was that there were 8 laws. I didn't invent them. I discovered them by comparing all these social transformations, that there are 8 laws that are key to creating change. And if you'd like, I'll list them.
Yes, please.
Okay, the first law, these are not, by the way, what you would expect at all. You know, when I got into this about how do you create social change, I thought, oh, well, it's about raising money or having the best publicity or, you know, that kind of stuff. No, it's not about that at all. The first law is the individuals individually and the group collectively must share a common intention. And, you know, if you've ever belonged to a school group or a church group or a political group, trying to get everybody on the same page so that they share a common intention, not an easy thing to do, but you have to do that. Mm-hmm. The individuals and the group have to reach a common consensus. And you see that, I learned that from the abolitionists and from the women suffragettes, particularly. And also from the Quakers. The Quakers are a very, very interesting group of people because very few people know them. There aren't very many. There's I don't know, a couple hundred thousand in the United States. There's a few hundred thousand more all over the world. And yet, if you look at major social transformations, you find that again and again, the Quakers play a major role in making it happen. And that's because they have worked out these 8 laws. The second law is the individuals in the group may have goals, but they may not have cherished outcomes. Again, I learned this from the abolitionists. I would read somebody's diary, and they were in the early 1800s or 1900s, and they would say, I loathe slavery. It's a horrible, evil thing. I don't know if it's going to end in my lifetime, but I'm going to work as long as I live to make it go away. So they have a cherished, they have a goal, get rid of slavery, but they don't have a plan of exactly how it's supposed to happen. So that's the second law. The third law, the individuals in the group must accept that their goals may not be reached in their lifetimes and be okay with that. And again, from the abolitionists and the suffragettes, you know, they would say things like, women should be allowed to vote and should be considered equal to men. I don't know if that's going to happen in my lifetime, but I'm going to work for it, and I'm okay with that, even if it doesn't happen in my lifetime. And the fourth law, the individuals in the group must accept that they may not get either credit or acknowledgement for what they have done and be authentically okay with that. And again, if you look at, I learned this actually from a man who had known Gandhi and had been one of his people. And nobody, I mean, in India, they would know his name, but nobody in the United States knows his name, a man named Ishwar Sharma. But in any case, he said, I did it because it was the right thing to do, and it was the right thing to do. So I knew I would never get any acknowledgement for it, but that's not the point. The point was, it was the right thing to do. That is to get India independence, And Gandhi was able to do this without a war, which very few people talk about, but that's a huge deal. Think about that. He got independence. In fact, let me say, as long as I'm talking about him, they sent a reporter up to interview him from the Times of India just before he was assassinated. And the reporter said, my editor sent me up here to ask you a question. And he said, you know, it's kind of like Plonk, what's the question? And he said, how did you get the British, how did you force the British to give up their most prized colonial possession? How did you force them to leave and give us independence? You don't have any money. You don't have any official position. How did you do that? And Gandhi's answer was, and this is critical to all of this social change we're talking about, he said, it's not what we did that mattered, although it mattered. It's not what we said that mattered, although it did matter. It is the nature of our beingness, who we are, our character, that made the British choose. Notice the difference between force and choose. Choose to leave India and give us in, and give us independence without a war. So this all gets down to how individuals act and the choices they make. So now I said the fourth law. Fifth law, each person in the group, regardless of gender, religion, race, or culture, must enjoy fundamental equality, even as the various roles in the hierarchy of the group and its effort are respected. Now, what that means is we're high-order primates. We organize hierarchically. So that's okay. You organize hierarchically, but you have to recognize that everybody in the group has a fundamental equality, whether they're a man or a woman, whatever race, whatever religion, none of that matters. You have to, everybody has to have a fundamental equality. And you see that in the American Constitution. And it was put there largely because of Benjamin Franklin, who came to recognize this. And the sixth law is the individuals in the group must forswear, this is the hard part for me when I was younger, must forswear violence in word, act, or thought. Because when I was involved with the civil rights movement particularly, and I would go to these demonstrations and they would set the dogs on people, particularly on women, I just, my initial reaction was to some other kind of violence. But you have to forswear violence. It's your beingness, not your violence, that causes change. The seventh law, the individuals in the group and the group itself must make their private selves consistent with their public postures. I learned this from Benjamin Franklin. He was sent over to France by the American Congress to get money from the most autocratic conservative monarch in Europe to pay for the American Revolution, which, by the way, the whole thing ran through Benjamin Franklin's personal bank account. But after he got there for a while and was working with the Comte de Vergennes to get the French to help support the revolution, he got a letter from a woman who was a friend of his, and she said, Dr. Franklin, I think your valet is a spy, is spying on you and revealing what you're doing. And Franklin wrote back and he said, well, inasmuch as if he is a good valet, and he is, since I don't say anything in private that I would scruple to have made public, I don't care. And if you look at all of the political people and all, I mean, look at what's going on with Trump now, or you look at all these religious figures in the evangelical movement who, you know, Falwell and others who say one thing, but then it turns out, you know, they're doing something very different personally in their private life. So you have to make your private self and your public self one and the same. because you have to be authentically who you are. And the eighth law, the individuals in the group and the group collectively must always act from the beingness of life-affirming integrity. So if you want to be an agent of change that produces and fosters well-being, and this is the most important thing I'm going to tell you in this entire interview, every day you make lots of little choices. The things that you buy in the store, the shampoo, the animal pet food, the toilet paper, the gas you buy, everything you do, all of those are votes. They are votes to support different kinds of companies. And you need to find out which companies are supporting and fostering well-being and which are not. There are some very specific companies that are the oligarchs of those companies are funding the destruction of American democracy, for instance. You don't do business with those companies. So you have to find out what it is you're doing and not be unconscious. And every day on all these little choices you make, you always choose the choice that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being. You tell 10 of your friends to do that and ask them to join you and tell 10 of their friends. And I can tell you that the people that are going to listen to this program and this interview, if they will do what I'm saying, it's called the quotidian choice. Every day you make these little choices. Before you make the choice, you find out what it is you're supporting with your money when you buy these things. And you choose only companies which support well-being and foster compassionate well-being. If you do that and you get 10 people and tell them you're doing it and they get 10 people, the people that are listening to this program can change the outcome of the election in 2024 and make it an election where people who are compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being are elected. Now, that may seem very bizarre, but that's how Martin Luther King was able to get the Civil Rights Act passed. That's how Gandhi got freedom and independence for the Indians. You don't think about it in those kind of simple, basic ways because you think, well, I don't have any, you know, who am I? I'm just an ordinary guy. I don't have any money particularly. I don't have any political power. I don't have any official position. It doesn't matter. When 10%, and we know this from research, when 10% of any cohort, whether it's a church group, a school group, a community group, a city council, or a national congress, when 10% of the people change their perspective about something, change their consciousness, and choose to support and foster well-being, all the other people in the community or the group or whatever, they have to accommodate for that. So we have the ability, just the people that are listening to this program, you have the ability to change the course of the 2024 election to support and foster well-being if you make the quotidian choice every day and you get your friends and they get their friends and they get their friends. Just do the math.
So, first of all, I love that and thank you. And your book, The Eight Laws of Change, I really enjoyed that as well. But I'd like to know, do you have any thoughts? One of the things that our group is focused on, one of the well-being aspects that we care deeply about is humans' relationship with the earth, with mm-hmm. nature. Can you extrapolate, or maybe not even, that sounds like too big a jump. What comments would you have in terms of that arena?
Well, once you recognize that all consciousness is interconnected and interdependent, I mean, think about that for a minute.
It blows my mind.
When you get the idea that you live in a matrix of consciousness, mm-hmm. consciousness is causal and fundamental. Then, for instance, just you personally, just each individual, You change the way you eat. You stop eating things which cause vast pollution. That usually means that you stop eating mammals. That may be very hard for some people. It also means that you only buy, as I just said, things which are made by companies that foster well-being, because it's not just well-being for the company. It's not just about making money. You know, the problem in the United States right now is that we have two big problems. One is we are becoming a majority-minority racially nation, and we have only one social priority, and that's profit. We don't have health care. We have an illness profit system. We don't have our insurance is an illness is a profit system. Everything is designed to make profit. It's not designed to produce well-being. If you look at the social outcome data, infant mortality, maternal mortality, education, obesity, heart disease, cancer, longevity, and you compare the United States to other developed nations, we are doing appallingly badly. I mean, really badly. We have, our healthcare system is really the worst amongst the developed nations. And it's driven entirely by money. So when you look at countries that are making decisions and creating policies, I'm talking about Scandinavian countries, New Zealand, the Netherlands, for instance. When you look at what they're doing, they are happier people. The most happy country in the world is Finland. I think we're something like 37th. When you make those kind of choices, your interaction, you know, you got a picture of trees behind you. Mm-hmm. If you recognize, you look at what's going on, you want to support things which stop pollution. The plastic pollution that's going on, for instance, it's gotten so bad that it's moving into people's bodies, these little microplastics. They're in the fish. They're in the things we eat. People are getting them in their own bodies. So you stop doing things which pollute. You stop doing things which cause stress on other living beings. You support things that if you garden, you start doing organic gardening, biodynamic gardening. You don't do things like Roundup, which has glyphosates in it and which cause cancer. And
I want to take, we have a few minutes left and I don't want to forget to put this part in. When you studied and you surveyed your remote viewers, by the way, are you a remote viewer?
Sure.
Okay. I was curious. And we look ahead because sometimes things feel pretty dire. When we look ahead, I want you to, if you don't mind, do two things. First, give us an uplift in our spirits of what you saw, they saw in 2045. And then before we close, I'd like you to tell the listeners about the event, the online event workshop that you are going to hold maybe next week, I think, or
I have a workshop. Oh, yes, okay.
But lift our spirits because.
Okay, well, I
take us out of the dire into the glorious future.
Well, I'm not sure how glorious it is, but in any case, and this is a whole long thing we don't have time to get into, but. Since 1978, I have been asking people to remote view the future. I started with 2050. Now I'm doing 2060. And I've had a total of about 6,000 people participate from all over the world. And the takeaways from this are that about 2040 to 2045, we're going to have something really major is happening. I actually now think I'm doing the analysis, but I now think it's actually a series of trends. Climate change, which is going to produce huge migrations involving millions of people. There are going to be three major migrations away from the coasts and out of the, because there's too much water, the submergence of large parts of coastal cities, the collapse of real estate as a result, out of the southwest because there's not enough water and the temperature gets too high, and out of the central states because of cataclysmic weather events like tornadoes. So a large percentage of the population is going to be moving around. A lot of it, I think, probably to the northwest or the northeast in the United States. I think the gender equality issue is going to come to a crisis in the 2040-2045 period, because you can see now in just the elections that just happened yesterday, very interesting, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the winner of the election was the progressive candidate, and the same thing was true in Chicago in the mayor's race. The progressive candidate won in the 2022 elections, where they thought there was going to be a huge red wave. Didn't happen. So I think what's happening is that particularly younger people, 18 to 34s, are going to vote in a much more progressive way than their parents. There's about a third of the white population who simply cannot tolerate gender equality and racial equality. So I think there's going to be more violence. What I think is going to happen is that the United States is going to stay one country, but real power is going to devolve to the states and groups of states that join together. You can see this in the red-blue schism that's going on right now. The Dobbs decision overturning Roe has already resulted in OBGYNs leaving the red states. In Sandy Point, Idaho, for instance, a city of about 9,000 people, the only hospital in the whole city, think about this, announced that they will no longer give obstetrical care of any kind. So if you're a woman in Sandy Point, Idaho, and you're going to have a baby, I'm not quite sure what you do. You have to go a couple hours away or something to another hospital, because your hospital locally doesn't do obstetrics anymore. You can already see the OBGYNs leaving the red states. And I think that women are going to get fed up with this and are going to push back in a big way. I think that's what these elections are telling us. There is a big movement amongst the red states to dismantle democracy, because this group of ultra-rightists are an increasingly small minority, but they want to stay in power. So there's the gerrymandering going on and the voter suppression and all that. So 2040, 2045, all of these things I think are going to come to a head. And then when we get on the other side of it, because when I talk to the 2060s, they tell me they have a problem trying to describe the whole thing. Oh, also, by the way, the end of the internal combustion engine, the movement out of carbon energy into non-carbon energy. But the description that they give of the world of 2060 is we live in smaller communities, that food growing has radically altered, that monoculture, chemical industrial agriculture has ended, medicine has changed substantially, there is much more genetic engineering has become a much more prominent part, so that children are born who aren't going to have cancer or heart disease or whatever. People's diets have changed very substantially. People don't travel as much by air. They travel by rail. The states have really defined themselves almost as two different countries, but the country, there, it remains one country with a federal government. But as I say, real power is devolving to the states, and of course that's what the red states have been pushing for, and they're going to regret it, because the problem with the red states is that they are only made possible by the blue states funding them. If you look, again, this is all about data. It's not about philosophy or partisanship. If you look at the data, what you see is that the red states, for every dollar they put in taxes into the federal treasury, they take more than a dollar out. And the blue states, for every dollar they put in, take less than a dollar out. And so at some point, I think the blue states are going to get tired of funding the red states. That's going to cause further exacerbation of this the great schism trend. People are working from home a great deal. I don't hear anybody describing to me skyscrapers full of offices as an example. Education has changed very substantially. Again, in the red states, by 2040, the red states are less interested in educating children and more interested in indoctrinating them in a particular political view. And you can see this going on in Florida right now, Mississippi. So the world seems to be calmer. We don't have a world war. It just seems to be quite different, and very much essentially two different countries. So then after that, that's 2040, 2045. By 2060, I think this begins to settle out, because the red state policy decisions just don't work. I mean, they don't produce good outcomes. I mean, you look, for instance, maternal mortality in Mississippi. I mean, it's a third world country. So by 2060, I think things begin to sort themselves out better. And I don't get, which is what everybody asked me, have extraterrestrials come and made contact? I don't get that. Nobody's describing that to me. The end of the internal combustion engine, I mentioned that. So cars are powered. You know, right now what we're doing is trying to recreate basically the gas station idea of having charge stations instead of gas stations. But I think what's going to happen, from what I read in the 2060s particularly, is that the roads are going to charge the cars as they drive over them. And that research is already starting. There are already several projects, both in the United States and elsewhere, where the roads charge the batteries of the electric cars that drive on them. I just saw a paper on how reefer trucks are going to put solar panels on their roofs to power the refrigeration of the reefer trucks. And the trucks themselves will be powered by electricity, not by by carbon energy. So I think all that's good. I think there's a much stronger awareness of the interconnection and interdependence of all life. And so in order to cope with what climate change is doing, we're going to very radically change the way we operate. We're going to have other pandemics. You know, when I first began in 78, I thought we were going to have a nuclear war, so that's really what my main focus was. And when they said to me, well, I said, have we had a nuclear war? And they say, no. I said, well, then the world must be much safer. And they said, oh, no, the world is much more dangerous. And I said, why? And they said, terrorism. In 1978, the only terrorism was the Irish, the Protestants and the Catholics in Ireland. But of course, today it's a major issue. I said, well, tell me what the status of the Soviet Union is. Because at that time I had just come out of government, and of course it was the big bipolar Cold War. And they said, well, the Soviet Union doesn't exist. And I had no idea what to do with that. I went around to people in the geopolitical world that I knew and said, can you imagine any reason why the Soviet Union would cease to exist? And they said, you know, that's just crazy stuff. And I asked them about health care, and they talked to me about this very different health care. And then they said, but there's going to be a bunch of pandemics. I said, really? What do you mean by, you know, I'm thinking Spanish flu in 1918. They said, well, the first one will be a blood disease which crosses over from primates to humans in Africa, and it's going to kill millions of people. And I went around to a friend of mine who was the deputy director of National Institutes of Health at the time and said, do you know anything about a blood disease that's going to cross over from humans to from primates and that has the ability to kill millions of people? And he said, no, that's just nonsense. But of course, in 81, AIDS emerges, kills 35 million people. Then SARS, then Ebola, H5N1, and now COVID, which has killed millions of people. And we're going to have more of them because as climate change goes on, the vaccines, viruses and the bacteria are going to mutate to accommodate the changed circumstances of their situation. And we're not going to have ability to protect ourselves from this. So we're going to have other pandemics. I see that now. I did not understand that at all in the beginning. So there's some good things that are going to happen, a lot of good things, but they're also, it's going to be a very difficult time between now and 2045. That's really not very long, you know, if you think about it.
But I think the point I want to say, and maybe this is just to make myself feel a little better through all of this, we do have choice.
Yes.
And as you said, every day making the choices that, and, you know, I have a slide of your 8 laws of change simplified, but making the choice to foster well-being in every decision you make, making a choice that recognizes that we are interdependent, including animals, including nature, including the dandelions nobody seems to want in their front yard, so they're always spraying them with something. But those choices will help shift.
Yes, yes, that's very true. And everything you're saying is correct. I mean, who knew until a couple of years ago that bees could count and could recognize your face? Who knew that fungus had a measure of consciousness?
I didn't know that.
Well,
I did have this awareness that mushrooms are a big deal right now. They're going to, our relationship with mushrooms, I just have this sense is really.
Well, fungi have consciousness. That's what we're learning, and that's what's transforming science, is that we are beginning to recognize that consciousness is, that living beings of all kinds have a measure of consciousness.
Octopuses are smart as heck.
I had a friend who was an octopus.
They're smart.
Oh, absolutely. When I was one of my expeditions down in the Bahamas, we located the Brig Leander. I would go diving after the day's work where we would moor the ship. I had a research vessel, And I would go down and next to a coral reef, and there was an octopus who lived there. And I started out with a long pole, and I would put a piece of fish on the end of it and hold it, and the octopus would come down, and then I made it shorter and shorter and shorter until I could just hold the octopus, the fish myself, and the octopus would come down, and they have a beak like a parrot almost, that would come down and eat this, take this piece of fish, and his arms would stroke my wrist through my wetsuit as sort of a thank you. And I had a moray eel, who were quite scary. Same thing. I started with the long pole with a piece of fish, and I made it shorter and shorter. And he liked to have his nose scratched. So
I love that.
So, I mean, what it taught me was everything has a measure of consciousness. And once you get that, then you realize that you do harm to another consciousness, and when you do harm to yourself, because it's all interlinked and interdependent. And that's what we're discovering. As we break down the ecosystems, look at what's happened to the rainforest in Brazil, look at what's happening to all the plastic that's in the oceans, yeah, because we dump all this stuff and what it's doing. Look at these chemicals that we use. The other thing I wanted to say is get all the toxins out of your house. Read the labels. Use organic soaps. Don't spray things that have smells in them. Don't fill your house up with chemicals. The toxin level of the average American body is appalling, because we live in this chemical world, and we're told, oh, well, this will make your room smell good. What they don't tell you is it's got things in it which cause problems. And a lot of the diseases that people suffer from result from these stresses that are caused by these toxins. So you clean the toxins out of your life. You clean the toxins out of your garden and your yard. You meditate every day for 20 minutes, and you make these choices, that the quotidian choice, where you choose the compassionate life-affirming choices. And in that way, you become a powerful agent of change. And when you get the other people in your family to do that, and you get your friends, you tell your friends to do it, then it just ripples out. And that's how we change. It's not going to happen because some political leader is going to come along. This is something that has to come from ordinary people making choices that foster well-being, that recognize the interdependence and interconnection of all life.
Thank you. We're going to close, but do you want to briefly talk about your workshop?
Oh, yes. I do a workshop called Opening to the Infinite, which is about everything that has to do with what science knows about consciousness. And if you'll go to glidewing.org, you can find this workshop, Opening to the Infinite, and you can sign up. The next one will be on the 22nd of April. You can go to my personal website, stephanaschwartz.com. You'll see a way to link into that there. You can also get all of my papers. I make as much as possible. I make everything freely available. You can get my books from my personal website, both my novels and my nonfiction books. You can go to YouTube and see hundreds of interviews like this. So I make as much as I can. I make everything freely available.
Well, thank you for making your time available for us tonight. It was really, really wonderful to hear the things you know and to learn from you. And thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And we're going to close. I'm Doc Martin on Maximum Medicine. And Stefan Schwartz was here. And this will be archived and available if, and on the YouTube. And I'll send you a link. And have a good evening, Stefan. It was so nice for you to be here.
My pleasure. Thank you. Sharon. You take care. Stay safe and well.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Maximum Medicine Radio with Doc Martin. Tune in next time while the doc talks health, spirituality, and the impact your beliefs have on every part of who you are, body and soul. Doc Martin unpacks the challenges we face as human beings and teaches callers to open the door between the scientific and the mystical. To learn more about Doc Martin and Maximum Medicine, visit www.SharonMartinMD.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.